Hello, and welcome to the Article 1 podcast with Tom and Tim. This podcast examines the United States Congress from an institutional perspective with a variety of congressional experts. All views expressed are the opinions of the speakers only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Federalist Society. I am your host, Tom Raneri, and with me, as always, is my co-host and devil's advocate, Tim Courtney. Tim, say hello.
Hello, good to be here.
With us today on the inaugural podcast of the Article 1 podcast, we have with us Corey Crowley, a friend of mine, a Republican strategist, and a longtime staffer on the Hill. Say hello, Corey.
Yeah, hello. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Will you please give us a little bit of a background on you, your career and what you've been doing and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I started in Congress in 2001 with Senator Grassley from Iowa, and was on his staff for a decade, kind of worked my way up from the bottom all the way almost to the top, not quite all the way, but most of the way there, and did 10 years with him when he was chair of the Finance Committee, got him reelected in 2010, and then decided to leave and start my own consulting firm. So I do public relations, public policy here in D.C., and I also advise several Republican candidates, both Senate, House, and was recently with John Kasich's presidential campaign.
That's amazing. Okay, that's fantastic. Our topic today, as you know, is Congress's approval rating. What consequences their approval rating being so low are, and finally, what possibly we might do to alleviate that particular concern. So maybe you want to tell us a little bit why you think the Congress's approval rating is not great. I mean, my understanding is in 2015, it hit a record low. In Gallup at 11%. My understanding is it's a little higher now, closer to 20%, but why don't you give us a sense of why you think that might be the case?
A huge bump, right? Yeah, they're right. 18. Isn't that great? You know, I think that there's a couple of problems that Congress has, one of which is that as a whole, they're greatly disliked, and I think that's just the nature of having 535 people who you ask what their approval rating is all at one time. When you ask what their approval rating is individually, particularly people of their own member of Congress or their own senator, they hold them in much higher regard. You know, for example, in Iowa, in a poll that was done right before the election, Congress's overall approval rating was about 21%. So they find them a little more favorable than other voters throughout the country. But yet Senator Grassley, they found, 63%. Congressman David Young, they find 54%. And kind of on and on in that pattern. And that's what you see around the country. For some reason, people think that as a whole, they're dirty scoundrels. But hey, my guy's the one good one that's there.
Right.
And so that's kind of the overarching problem, I think, just with this polling question. But then the other thing is that all these members of Congress campaign and make promises in each of their individual districts and each of these senators in their own states. And they get to Washington and have to compromise in ways the president doesn't. So you probably get a truer approval rating when you ask what people think of the president, because it's one man trying to keep his one set of promises, as opposed to one person who made a bunch of promises that all the other guys don't know about and really don't care about because they're only out there to try to deliver on what they promised their constituents.
Sure, that makes sense. But isn't it, I mean, to a certain extent, isn't it a problem that it's so low? I mean, in terms of collective action problems and things like getting things done, I mean, doesn't it kind of weaken them as a body?
Oh, I think it absolutely does. It not only is it a huge problem, but you've seen Congress, I think, react very adversely to this problem over the course of the last few decades. If you read almost any bill now, at the end of it, there's a little clause that then gives a ton of authority to the bureaucracy for rulemaking. For a lot of people talk about in Obamacare how there were over 1,000 designations of authority given to the bureaucracy. And that's a direct result, I think, of Congress's low approval rating and inability really to work together and get things done. They try to deal with the softball issues or the bigger broad issues themselves and then leave all the details, the granular stuff, the things that could really upset people to the bureaucrats who aren't accountable to the public.
No, I'm sorry, Tim, you were going to say something?
Yeah. So my question is, you sort of point to a low approval rating as maybe an effect of delegation and this sort of a lot of times the term you'll hear is abdication of congressional authority. Do you think that has an effect on approval rating, or is it sort of the other way around? I mean, I don't think I guess I find it tough to imagine if your everyday voter is being polled on his member of Congress, or Congress as a whole, this sort of administrative mission creep is going to be at the forefront of his mind, right? So,
well, I think it's like a chicken and the egg scenario. You've got many cases where they abdicate this authority just because they're so gridlocked, they can't get things done, and their approval rating's so low, they don't feel like they have mandates to do a lot of things, and they certainly don't want to do anything to make an already bad approval rating worse. And a lot of times the rulemaking, those are the things that really affect individual voters or specific segments of the population that may come out and vote against you. But I think you're right, too. Is there an argument to be made for the fact that maybe if they did a little more of this themselves, their approval rating would be higher? Maybe. And I think that that's something that ought to be looked at. But of course, then, you know, laws are so big and complicated. Do voters really vote based upon the law anyway, or the duties that these people do? I don't think so. When you ask these approval rating questions, they're probably more just talking about the narrative that they see out in the public and the narrative that's being painted for them by the media. And unfortunately, as we saw with this past presidential election, what really sells is controversy. What really sells is drama. And so when the news is talking to the public about what goes on day to day in Congress, they're not highlighting the real work that's being done. They're highlighting the, you know, the controversies and the loud members and the people who are throwing flames and trying to burn the place down.
If I could just give myself a pat on the back right now, I just want to say the Article One podcast point is to talk about that day to day bread and butter congressional work and to show how the legislature actually does function and is doing more than I think a lot of people think it is.
Yes.
But I do want to get back real quick to something you had said earlier, and that is it's your contention that Congress members will punt, essentially, authority to regulatory agencies as a way either A, of avoiding to make difficult decisions, or B, as a way of kind of as a workaround their low approval rating because they don't have a mandate. And I guess that's fine as far as it goes, but I wonder why then they don't also kind of really get involved with, once the regulations are made, being able, going in there and kind of changing them or striking them down, because they certainly have authority to do that, to really go after the regulations after they're made by the agencies, because it seems to me that then they could say, not only do we give a mandate, but we're also protecting the people from regulatory overreach, and that seems to me like a win-win for them. Do you have any perspective on why that might be?
Well, I think you're right, and I think that just as a partisan breakdown goes, Republicans are more willing to do that in many cases than Democrats are, and I think that's just a difference in view and philosophy of the way government should work. Democrats tend to be more comfortable with the bureaucrats making rules and then living by them, and kind of the fairness. They see those as, you know, objective people who aren't dealing with the electorate day to day. And so, you know, they're more open minded to those types of rulemaking. But they do strike down in egregious circumstances. I think that we'll see some waterway regulations struck down coming up in the new administration, and now that Republicans control Congress. And so I think they do it, but I think it really takes a loud drumbeat from huge portions of the electorate to get them to do that. Because don't forget, one of the biggest problems that Congress faces is their schedule. There's only 365 days in a year, and they're only here legislating probably 180 of those. And so when you talk about having to have votes to strike down individual regulations that have been made by the bureaucracy, that takes a day, sometimes two or three, out of hearing calendars and committees, and then out of floor time for debate and voting when they really feel like they should be tackling big, broad issues. And so I think if you visit or did visit with Senator McConnell, like I have a few times this fall, he really found that to be the biggest struggle that he has is I talked to him specifically about the need for some prison reform legislation. And he said that, you know, sentencing reform is a big deal, but he just doesn't have time on the floor to deal with that when he's got bigger things that are mandated he has to do, like pass budgets and appropriations bills. And so I think that's a real problem, too. So I think if they abdicate these duties, the ability of them to go back and really provide a good check and balance, there's just not enough time to actually do it in the way it would need to be done.
So your contention is they're not in session enough.
Well, I think that they should probably just do a little bit more of this regulating on the front end themselves when they write the bills, and give less of it to the bureaucracy to be written. I think it's dangerous when you allow elected, non-elected officials to start writing more of the pages of law that actually go into the code than the Congress that's elected is writing.
Sure, but as a counterpoint, isn't it also true that, I mean, we can't really, I mean, the problem of expertise and kind of economic analysis and scientific analysis of environment, I mean, I'm not saying that they can't be self-serving sometimes, but I mean, does Congress really have the, let's say, the brain power to write these kind of regulations?
Well, probably not. But I would argue, and I think a lot of your membership and listenership, I think, would argue in the vein of individual liberties and freedom, that Congress really doesn't need to get into the weeds on a lot of this stuff. I mean, I find it to be remarkable. An example I like to point to is Abraham Lincoln, the Emancipation Proclamation, frees the slaves in less than a page. If you were to try to do that same thing today, can you imagine how that would be written? You know, any African-American, African defined as anybody from this country between this period of time who lives in the United States, but they had to have come here between this day, and, you know, the pigment of their skin needs to be between these ranges. And, I mean, this is what Congress would do today if they were to write that bill and try to do it. And, you know, we'd have slavery still in America. I mean, it's so I think if they just get a little more broad with stuff and stick to their actual job, which is to write laws that are more on spirit than letter, because I think most people know practically how to apply law, right? Don't go kill somebody. It's pretty simple. But yet we've, you know, got 80 degrees of murder now these days and 100 technicalities to get you out of it.
True, true.
So anyway, we'd be better off if they were just broad, in my opinion.
So when you mentioned Senator McConnell and how he feels that he should be dealing with issues in broader strokes, that's not a criticism. That's you think that's good.
No, I think attitude. I think it'd be better off if that's what we did.
So what do you think? I'm interested in what you said about the schedule, because it is pretty hectic. I'm wondering if you think there's any sort of comparative disadvantage that Congress might find itself with compared to how long the executive agencies and the executive branch are at work or at their desks, I guess. I'm just wondering if you think there's any interaction between those problems.
You mean the fact that the bureaucrats work 40 hours a week every week and Congress is only here part-time?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that gets to another argument, and I don't know where you all come down on this, but when you hear people talk about term limits, and you talk about term limiting Congress, they're already here part-time. And if you were to term limit them, you just give the bureaucracy even more power. And I think that's what people forget, is they're the most important or the most powerful people here in this town are the regulators, the people who have full-time government jobs and have had them for decades. You know, once you get into the federal bureaucracy, it's very difficult to be removed, no matter what you do. I find it interesting nobody's ever pulled on that. Maybe somebody should, because they're probably somebody who's actually less popular than Congress. So maybe they ought to start doing that, and Congress will feel very puffed up and inflated that their approval rating is 15 or 20%. But if you the more power you give those people, it's just more difficult, and you can't hold them accountable. As we noted earlier, Congress doesn't have the time. You can't, with a staff of 6 in the House or 20 in the Senate, possibly oversee all the regulations that are being written and all the agencies and their budgets and what they're spending it on. You know, these stories have just come out about the Pentagon burying, you know, $100 billion worth of fraudulent spending. And it takes time to uncover those things, and nobody in Congress really has the time to do that these days.
That is that's a great point. I don't want to get a little too off. I feel like we're starting to drift a little bit, so I want to kind of bring it back to congressional approval ratings. And I feel like so what we talked about is everyone likes their individual congressman, but people don't like Congress as a whole. Is there anything else going on there? I mean, what other reasons might there be for why people don't like Congress? I mean, what comes to my mind, and you can fact check me on this, but what comes to my mind is that they're not actually, the perception is that they're gridlocked, they're not getting anything done. It's very acrimonious. I mean, what do you think about that?
No, I think that's absolutely true. And I think that there's some potential solutions to that, although I don't know how feasible they are to get passed. But, you know, one of them is that the way congressional districts, particularly for the House, are drawn these days is by partisan state legislatures, and they draw them to be very safe. So if you are a Republican elected official in the vast majority of seats held by Republicans, the only threat you have of losing your seat in Congress is from a primary. So what does that encourage? That encourages you to run to the right, not to work across the aisle, because if you're going to lose your seat, it's going to be to somebody from your own party who's probably more extreme than you. And same with Democrat seats. It's what we want to encourage, I think, is people to come together and work across the aisle. But our system doesn't, at least the way right now we draw districts and elect members of the House of Representatives, doesn't lend itself to that very well at all. There are a few states who've pioneered ways around this, Iowa being one of them. And our congressional districts are drawn by a computer, with only the only consideration being population. So long as the population deviation is under a percentage point, that's a district as contiguous as possible. None of these snaking districts like they have in Texas. And it makes for much more competitive races. And it makes for, I think, members of Congress whose approval ratings are higher. And I think you see that in that the incumbents are regularly reelected in states that have this.
Okay. So what it's sounding like you're saying is that party politics at the state level is actually one of the things that's messing up congressional ability to the ability of Congress to actually perform.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think, too, you know, nobody probably wants to be this introspective, but when you ask people what their opinion is of Congress, I think they forget that Congress is really just a reflection of the grassroots, really, when you think about it. And when you think about, you know, any conversation any of us might have had around our Thanksgiving tables recently with our families, mine was a lot more partisan this year than it typically is. And we're mostly all Republicans, but, you know, I have, you know, family who really loves Trump, really hates Trump, all Republicans. And so when you look at how divided we are as an electorate as a whole, as a population, it translates up to Congress. The funny thing is, much like the reviews of Congress, none of us would find ourselves to be terribly partisan or disapprove of ourselves if we were asked for a poll, I'm sure. But as a whole, we'd say the electorate's very partisan and, you know, we disapprove of the way they do things. So it's kind of the same.
No, right. I mean, I'm certainly right. And I'm very, I mean, I know that I'm both right and moderate and prudent and good. And everyone else is just wrong.
Yes.
and so I just, you know, that's the operation I work on. So
yeah. And I think that's true of most people. Right.
That makes sense. But I don't, I mean, I don't want to go ahead and just blame the electorate. I mean, there is a certain amount of gaming of the system by the leadership, isn't there? And I mean, like the impact of, I mean, like, how much do you think that the perception among the electorate of the impact of money on the system is having on the approval rating of Congress?
I actually think that the impact of money on politics is a lot less than people think it is. You know, don't forget, even the largest company, you know, if you're Boeing or if you're Microsoft or whomever, you can only give $10,000 from a federal PAC to anyone, just to a House member, to a senator, or to the president. You can get your leadership and your CEOs together to write personal checks, but those are also capped. So the amount of money that there is isn't that extreme in direct contributions, although, of course, with Citizens United and everything that you can now do through super PACs, there's a lot more that companies can do with corporate funds to influence elections. But I think if you were to ask members of Congress, it probably makes you a little more toxic, actually, if you give a lot of money to try to get into the office just for the fear that, you know, they'll think it looks bad. So they, you know, try to stay away from that in many cases. But also, the thing they hate the most is fundraising. I mean, they hate doing it. They hate asking for money. They don't like going to the fundraisers for the most part, which, you know, that never gets reported. I think a lot of the public believes these members love to, you know, go down to a steakhouse and spend 2.5 hours at night, you know, talking about the intricacies of policy with, you know, folks from the industry. trust me, they'd rather be home watching TV like all of us, I think.
That makes sense.
But so I think it does have an impact more on leadership than it does on individual members. I think leaders definitely know which industries care about certain things and where maybe they'll give $10,000 checks to each of their members if they support a particular bill. So I think that does play a lot more into what bills get brought up for votes and than it does on individual members and the vote they cast, if that makes sense.
That does make sense. Do you think that the flattening of committees or the disempowering of leadership would have a beneficial effect on the processes of legislating? Would it empower lower level members to really kind of get their hands into policy? I mean, how much do you feel like that's affecting the?
I think it would help some. I think the committees that probably would help the most to do away with would be things like the National Republican Senatorial Committee, and the Democrats have their counterpart, and same for the House, because those committees really play undue influence. They are both the campaign arm of the House and Senate, both sides of the aisle, respectively. And they also, based upon which members they think are going to have difficult races, make recommendations to leadership. You know, hey, you got to put this guy on a major committee because it's easier to raise money if you're on the Appropriations Committee or the Ways and Means Committee than it is if you're on the Administrative Oversight Committee. And so they have an undue influence putting members in. So you end up with members, you know, you might have doctors who aren't serving on a healthcare related committee, or veterans who aren't serving on an armed services related committee because they come from easy districts and don't need the cash. So they get junk committees so that the really vulnerable guys can get the good stuff, even though they don't have the expertise.
Oh, that's interesting.
I'm interested in some things that you said earlier about fundraising. So it sounds like fundraising is something that's a big drain on the members' time, and that the amount of money spent on elections is relatively less consequential than some people might think. So what would you make of a proposal for publicly funded elections?
You know, I think there's an upside and a downside. The upside is obviously you spend less time fundraising and everybody knows where the money comes from and everybody's on an equal playing field. The downside is if, you know, I decide I want to move to Arizona tomorrow and, you know, qualify for the ballot and run for office, even though I don't know anybody and I don't stand a real chance, how do you say that I don't get any public funds, but, you know, somebody who's, you know, maybe the attorney general of Arizona is going to run for Senate, and he does deserve him because he's a legitimate candidate. I think it's an okay idea. You just got to find a way to be sure that, and I don't know how you would do that, that only qualified or decent candidates who really stood a chance could get the public funds, because if not, you're just going to dole out, you know, $1 million to every Joe Schmo who says they want to be on the ballot.
That's a good way to get rich. So I guess the next question is, what do you think the impact of the low congressional approval rating is overall on Washington, generally speaking? I mean, we talked about the bureaucracy, but going beyond that, I mean, in the separation of powers questions, like Congress v. President, Congress v. courts, or just Congress, generally speaking, as an institution, which is what we're interested in. What is the real downside for them? Because if each individual member is getting reelected, maybe it doesn't matter so much that they have a low approval rating. But on the other hand, it seems like maybe that's important. And I just want to hear what you have to say about that.
Well, I think that's a keen observation. And I think that the biggest problem it causes is that it gives the executive even more authority, right, and more power, because they're more popular and their bully pulpit is stronger when Congress is weak and when Congress is disapproved of. And it allows them to go out and constantly keep kicking the, you know, the dead horse of Congress. And it works. You see it with, you remember kind of George W. Bush pioneered this, I think, at least in modern times, this idea that instead of proposing a lot of stuff to Congress and going up and hashing it out with them behind closed doors, he was going to go on the road. And so when he wanted tax reform in 2001 and 2003, he had huge banners printed, took it to the road in key states, and went out and sold it to the American public first and said, Congress doesn't do anything. They're unpopular. You know, they're horrible. Let's call them all up and tell them that we need to do this. And so he got his proposals through pretty much the way he wanted them, written by him and his administration. And I think that that's similar to what you saw Obama do with Obamacare and some of the early things that he had. You know, he took the message directly to the public, campaigned literally against Congress in the legislative process, and kind of bullied them into doing exactly what he wanted. And Congress doesn't really have the moral authority with such low approval ratings to go out and counter that in any way.
That's interesting. That's an interesting observation. I guess the question is, was Congress being particularly recalcitrant, just for my own edification, was Congress being particularly recalcitrant with the George W. Bush tax reform tax proposals?
Well, sure, because in the early days, Democrats controlled the Senate, and then we had a 50-50 Senate for the first several years of the Bush administration. And so he needed Democrat buy-in on what he was doing. So what he had to do was go campaign against Congress. And I think, not to get off the trail here, but one interesting thing that I think is going to be interesting to watch going forward the next year here is when it comes to individual members of Congress, Donald Trump is so popular with such a grassroots chunk of the population that rather than rail against Congress as a whole, you know, he could come, if you're a member of Congress from, you know, wherever, the first district of Maine, and you go against him on a bill, he could literally show up in Maine, hold a rally, which, I mean, if they're anything like his campaign rallies, you know, a third of the voters of the district will show up at and say, this guy didn't vote with me. He's obstructing me in Washington. Let's get rid of him. And start to actually, as opposed to railing against Congress as a whole, take out individual members. And it would be interesting to see if he tries that just once. You know, I don't think you have to do it twice. You know, you only got to shoot one hostage before they all do what you say. And it's going to be interesting because he might turn this whole concept on its head where he really does make particular members of Congress toxic in their own district as opposed to Congress as a whole being toxic but people loving their own member.
I see. That's interesting. That's kind of so that sounds kind of similar to use basically the inverse of the carrot, like the coattail carrot, right? You know, you vote with me, you're on my coattails, and to get people to buy in. And instead he's like, you come with me, you'll be on my coattails. So you don't come with me, I'm going to sink your ship.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. That makes a lot of sense.
And so that could change this dynamic a lot, which makes this conversation timely because maybe if we have it again in a year, much like a lot of politics, Donald Trump will have turned it on its head. Who knows?
That's true. Yeah. And we'll definitely have you back again. So don't worry about that.
So is there a short-term fix that you see? Is there a way for Congress to quickly rehabilitate its image and prestige, I guess, in a way that could have ramifications even, you know, within the next 4 or 8 years?
I think that Congress as a whole could raise its approval rating probably if it cranks out a lot of legislation in this next year and a half, if they show that gridlock's kind of behind us, we're moving past it. You know, we try to get some really major things done for the American public. The difficult thing with that is that it's going to make some individual members of Congress a lot less popular because if they have to compromise and sign on to a bill that's a little more moderate than their district may want as Republicans to get Democrat support, particularly in the Senate, where we're going to have 52 votes but need 60 for some things, that could make them less popular at home, especially if they get primaried. Of course, there's a ton of factors then when you start getting into that with 535 different people. So, you know, some are just naturally popular. Some are well-liked. You know, some have been there long enough that they can pretty much do what they want and get away with it. But I think for some freshmen, particularly who were elected in 14, which was a decent Republican year, or 16, which was obviously a very good Republican year, they could become very unpopular at home quickly if they're seen as giving in, especially when voters right now feel like they've given Republicans supreme control of the country. You know, you and I and presumably a lot of your listeners know that that's just not the way Washington works. We still need 8 Democrat senators to vote with us on things. There's going to be times we lose Republicans and need Democrats to fill in those voids as well. So it's not supreme power. But that doesn't change the fact that's what voters feel like they've given. So Republicans now particularly need to deliver. And I think Democrats are under a lot of pressure and their new leadership in the Senate, Senator Schumer from New York, to obstruct as much as they can because their party is demoralized and feels like we can't let Donald Trump and the Republicans in Congress completely destroy Obama's legacy. So it's up to Chuck Schumer and his 47 other loyal foot soldiers to try to stop it.
Fair enough. So one of the things that I noticed, I did a little bit of digging on Gallup, is that throughout from 1975 to around 2005, The congressional approval rating, despite some dips, generally speaking, was between 30% and 40%, with a low of 18% in 92 and a high in 2001, staying pretty high until looks like mid-2003. And what found, so the high was 84%, which is really, really high.
Yeah, that's astounding.
In 2001, right before 2002, and I imagine that that is 9/11.
Yeah.
So I feel like that national tragedy is not something we should be looking at to help Congress's approval rating. But I wonder also, the other side of that is the national tragedy brought the country together, and the president and Congress, and you were in there at this time,
yeah,
were you not?
Yeah, I was.
They were working pretty closely together to deal with the problem of terror. Is that your impression? Am I right about that?
Yeah, very closely together. It was a time of really high bipartisanship. So kind of to the point I was making earlier, you know, you can raise the congressional approval rating by being bipartisan and getting things done. Voters don't like it as much. I think it also reinforces the point we were talking about earlier, that George Bush kind of pioneered this idea of going out and campaigning against Congress. So it I think proves the point we were discussing, that congressional approval ratings have been so low since that trend started, and that Obama's definitely followed in.
I see. So, I guess the next question is, was it 2002 we had elections?
Yeah. Okay. Midterms.
How? I mean, what was the effect there? I mean, was there a lot of turnover because of the bipartisanship?
Republicans won pretty big in the 2002 midterm elections. There was turnover, but it was mostly of a few liberal Democrats, is at least in the Senate, as far as I can remember. And they were particularly ones who had voted against anything that was seen as making the country safer, as you know, after 9/11. There was a lot of that was controversial, as you well know. The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the creation of the Department of Homeland Security, which hadn't existed before that, you know, giving a lot more authority in the Patriot Act to surveil American citizens, and all those types of things.
Okay, so but I think that one of the big takeaway here is the fact that the 9/11 terror attacks and the wars had this kind of almost they created what we could argue is an aberration, right?
Yeah.
So the next highest is 57% in what it looks like starting in 94, going up until 98, 99. So the high was in, looks like 98 at 57%. And that was when Clinton was in the White House in his second term, but we had a Republican Congress.
Yeah.
And so what... And so now you weren't there at that time, right?
Correct.
But from your obviously from your expertise in Congress, what explains that, right?
Well, I think the fact that Bill Clinton worked very, very well with the Congress, whether it was the Republican Congress or the Democrat Congress, of course, minus the fact that they impeached him, but set that one issue aside as an outlier issue. And he worked with him on big stuff, obviously NAFTA. He worked with him on the Defense of Marriage Act, which has now been repealed, but was, you know, something that we'd never today see a Republican and Democrat coming together on. He had tax bills that he worked with them on. He had a very good working relationship with the Republican leadership in the House and Senate. And as some people are fans of saying about Bill Clinton, a lot of that had to do with his own personality. I mean, Bill Clinton's a guy that if he sees a riot coming at him, he jumps in the front of it, grabs a banner and says, "Hey, look, it's a parade." And now he's the leader. So he gets it. I mean, he gets how to even take opposition coming at him and, you know, swing it in his favor and use it as positive momentum going forward. And you saw that, I think, as well with George H.W. Bush, certainly with Ronald Reagan. But I think that Washington was a much different place back then, too. You know, up until 2000, 1999, Fox News didn't exist. MSNBC wasn't a big liberal force like it kind of is now in that partisan way. And so news is getting to the electorate in a much more partisan way now than it used to as well. So I think working together has become more toxic than it was just 15 short years ago.
That's an interesting point you bring up. What do you think about how new media is going to affect congressional approval ratings? I mean, things like this. I mean, this podcast. I mean, we're kind of jumping on a train that's been kind of barreling down the track now for some time, and people are getting more and more news from more and more decentralized areas. Do you think this is going to have a? I mean, obviously the on one hand, the conventional wisdom states, well, this means that there's going to be further atomization, right, of the American electorate. And the question is then, is that true? I mean, do you think that's the case, or do you think that we're going to actually see a more, I mean, are people going to have a better understanding of the world that they live in, or are we going to have more fake news, essentially?
Well, I think that there's going to be a purer, digestion of the news for sure. And I think that's actually to everyone's benefit. Podcasts like this that dig deep down, deep dives on issues, you know, help people gain a better understanding. You know, working in politics is like any industry. You know, I don't know a lot about dentistry, even though I go to the dentist every once in a while. Most voters don't know a ton about politics and the workings of Congress, even though they go to the voting booth once a year or once every other year. And that's okay. So things like this help. WebMD made us all smarter about the diagnosis our doctor gives us and turned some of us into, part-time doctors for ourselves.
Sure. And hypochondriacs. I'm fairly certain I have like three different types of cancer at this point.
Yeah, see, we all do. And but with Twitter and things like that, I think you see Donald Trump once again turning conventional wisdom on its head. He goes straight to the voters now. He doesn't rely upon the news to get his message out. He just gives it straight to the voters in the way that, he wants it to be heard. And other members of Congress do that as well and have very, very big Twitter followings. And I think that more than anything really has changed the dynamic, because you no longer have to, a lot of members have liberal papers in their district. You hear Republicans complain about this a lot, but now you don't need to go through the liberal paper to get your daily press release out with their spin then put on it. You can tweet it out yourself, put it out yourself by email blast to your district, or lots of members do little blogs or short vlogs and post them on their website. So I think it helps, and maybe that too drives up individual member of Congress approval rating, because voters feel now more connected to their individual member personally than they did when it was just reading about them in a newspaper. I never explored that thought, but I think that could be something that's true.
So how do you think more engagement with individual members by the electorate, what kind of effect down the road do you think that'll have on the approval rating of Congress as a whole, if any?
Well, it may actually start helping, to the extent that these members can get their message out, but in a somewhat unified way. You can't have 435 members of the House all promoting different messages, but if you can get them to all kind of say, hey, this is a great bill and here's why I'm supporting it, or, this is why I'm, proudly co-sponsoring this or that, it starts to counter that power of the president's bully pulpit and of the executive branch, and gives you a chance to, reach. If every member could reach their own district's voters who believe in them with the same message that, here's why we passed this, this is why it's good, presumably it would be digested better than the Speaker of the House saying it to the voters of the, 17th District of California. Nobody really cares what he thinks.
Yeah, but I guess the substantive work still needs to be there, because they still need issues to engage on and things to talk about. I guess that's a...
Absolutely, because they can't speak in the abstract as much as the executive can.
So another question I wanted to ask, moving on to, towards the end of the podcast here, moving towards what can be done to fix the problem. We already talked about one short-term thing and how that might affect polls, but I'm wondering what you think might be some good ways for Congress to, without jeopardizing their individual members' prospects, what they might be able to do to kind of turn around the institutional approval rating as a whole, first of all. And second of all, one of the things that occurred to me as we were speaking and what you were just saying is a lot of individual members, both in Senate and the House, they pass the buck, right? They say, for the last 6 years, we've been hearing about how a lot is not getting done because the Republicans are being obstructionist, right? And obviously, whatever party is not in power is going to say that the other side is just not being cooperative and it's their fault, right? I guess the question I want to ask is, do you think that something that could help the approval rating of a whole of Congress is if the leadership comes forward and rather than saying this is the bureaucracy's fault, this is the president's fault, this is thus and so's fault, they come out and just sincerely say, look, here are the problems that we're facing. We haven't found a way to overcome it, and that's on us. I mean, just basically taking responsibility, because in my personal – now, maybe politics is different. This is why I'm asking you. But in my personal experience, if you make an apology to someone and you take responsibility for your action, they're more likely to accept that apology rather than if you say, well – Susie Cream Cheese, it's her fault, right?
Yeah.
And I'm just, I'm just curious, what your reaction is to that. And then you can go and give me some of your own ideas about what you think we can do to improve, or what you think Congress can do. We can't do anything, but what you think Congress can do to improve its institutional approval rating.
Yeah, I think you're right. The executives obviously often more willing to say this is my fault because hey, they're in there for longer terms, 4 years, and they're term limited, so they can get away with some of that. And it's easier to apologize for yourself than for a whole institution like Congress. But no, I think you're right. And I've often thought that the American public would be much more trusting of Congress if Congress would just work together and admit when they can't, when they haven't figured things out yet. You know, obviously, the deficit's a huge problem, but unfortunately, we can't come together and figure out a way to make this happen. And even if you kind of crowdsource or open source it and say, but, you know, if every member of Congress puts a survey on their website the same week and says, but send us all your ideas, at least it engages the public and makes them feel like these are humans up there. And that's the other part of the problem a lot of members have. When they do stumble, fall, have a problem, they've allowed themselves to be put on such a pedestal by trying to purport that they're perfect all the time, that then it's a big tumble when they fall. But if people see you as a Joe Schmo, a regular guy that, you know, is just, this is your job, you go to Congress, like I go teach school or whatever else, I think that they'd have a lot more empathy for you when it comes to getting these big tasks done, and give you a lot more latitude and rope to go make deals and compromise and accomplish things because they'd realize the difficulty of it.
Why don't you think they're doing that?
Because you have to have quite the ego to run for public office in the first place.
Oh, I see.
And it gets only bigger once you get there. I think it's the easy answer.
Maybe we should get a psychologist on the podcast next.
Maybe you should. But as far as what they could do to fix it, I think quick and easy solutions, write simpler legislation. There's a bill that gets passed every year in the House to do away with the legalese and kind of the lawyer speak of legislation and just put it into simple English. It never makes it very far, this bill. But
be careful now, your audience is lawyers.
I know. But the thing is, the American public just has trouble digesting these things for the same reason that mentioning the deficit again, people see it as a problem, but they don't really see it as a huge problem all the time because $20 trillion is incomprehensible to most human beings. It's incomprehensible to me, and it's incomprehensible, I think, to most people. And that's how all these bills are that Congress passed. When you pass an 800-page bill that's supposed to do nothing more than fund cancer research, you can't explain that to the public and even pass it off as an accomplishment, you know what I'm saying? Because it just goes in one ear and out the other. It's too long, too complicated. Too many pundits can break down little sections of it and tear that apart and then make the whole thing seem awful just because of the one sentence they found that was badly written or did something they disapprove of. So write simpler bills, pass more bills, work across the aisle more, and I think that you'd see your approval rating go up quite a bit as a whole in Congress.
Do you think it is possible to pass a simple bill like you're describing and still not actually just end up ceding power to the executive?
I think you'd probably end up ceding less power to the executives and maybe a little more power to the courts.
For interpretation?
Yeah, because I think, the executive can only do as much as you've given them the authority to do. They don't actually get to interpret the law most of the time. They can add, changes to it through the policymaking process, but only to the extent they're given that authority by Congress. Now, the courts can interpret it. But I think courts do a far better job of interpreting the spirit and not getting into the weeds than the bureaucrats do. And when you give them the authority to write regulations.
So, I think the courts are also generally much more highly regarded publicly than Congress is, at least. Certainly the Supreme Court is. I don't know how that would break down for.
I think you're right in the sense that courts are more deferential to the separation of powers and the constitutional law than administrative agencies are. Administrative agencies, you know, have an axe to grind, so to speak. They have a mission. They want to get that mission done, and they're going to do what they need to do it. Whereas a judge, you know, they presumably, you know, pride themselves on their, you know, their impartiality and their ability to understand the law.
And I just think they have a sort of public prestige that Congress maybe lacks, the kind of same issue they were talking about.
So the problem, though,
for whatever that's worth,
I think you're probably right. But at the same time, you have the problem of, do you want, I mean, if you leave it too open-ended, if you pass legislation that's too open-ended, you're essentially giving the courts and those members who are open to it the ability to legislate from the bench, to as we saw with the King v. Burwell decision, to sort of go in and get to the result that they want. That's my perspective of what King v. Burwell is. I mean, there's a whole other argument about how they correctly cited the statutes of interpretation. They correctly they provided legal reasoning for their position. I don't particularly approve, but there is kind of an opening for that when you have open-ended legislation, in my opinion. And then I'm sorry, this is not the Tom Raneri show. This is the Interview Corey Crowley show. But I do want to mention one other thing, and that is that when you do pass legislation, and you do give the power to the bureaucrats, I mean, they do have for instance, the SEC will write a letter saying, we interpret this mandate from Congress to mean this. And it has less to do with what Congress actually wants them to do and more to do with what they want to do.
Yes.
And so, I mean, I guess you said, you know, they can only have the power that Congress gives them, but isn't there a certain amount of leeway or at least orthopraxy, which kind of allows them to go ahead and do what they want to with congressional mandates?
Yeah, there is a degree of that. And there's also the situation that the executive often gets to decide what they're going to enforce in law just because of restrictions of budgets and time and resources. And so often they'll, if they don't like something Congress did, they'll just decide, hey, we're just not going to enforce that part, which is a problem as well. But I think that there is one other piece of legislation that just came to mind, which has been introduced a couple Congresses in a row, and I'm not so sure that it made it any further this Congress than last, but maybe it'll do better in the coming Congress, called the RAINS Act. And I can't remember what the acronym stands for. Everything in this town's got an acronym and a cute name, but pretty much reigning in the bureaucracy. And
right.
And what it boils down to is Congress says if the regulations that are passed dealing with a certain bill exceed a certain amount of either impact, public impact measured by some metric, or would cause a certain amount of money to be spent beyond what Congress thought, then none of those regulations go into effect on that bill until Congress expressly passes the package. So, in other words, Congress would pass the bill, say, hey, you guys deal with the details, you send the details back to us, and we either say yes or no. And that might be a good first step, just forcing Congress to say, you know, take them or leave them, here are the regulations, and up or down.
So I think it's the Regulations from the Executive in Need of Scrutiny Act.
Aha. Uh-huh. See, everything's got a cute name.
That's right, exactly. It's a good one, though, right?
Yeah.
So we're kind of we need to start winding down here. I think we have about 50 minutes worth of recording. So I guess this will be a good time to sort of allow you your closing thoughts and what you think Congress should do going forward, what you think the next year is going to look like as far as congressional approval ratings go, and also. Just your general thoughts. I'd love to hear them. So,
I think if Congress starts off this next year with a bold policy agenda, and I think they're going to, it's going to be based in large part upon the proposals Paul Ryan has already put out, the Speaker. I think that if they get those passed, if they work across the aisle on it, if they'd spend a little more time being friendly and complimentary of one another, the approval rating of Congress will go up. It will make mad partisans on both sides of you know, the electorate who are extremely divisive. But I think most people appreciate common ground and appreciate when Congress gets things done for the American public. And I think that if they can do some of these things we talked about, getting their message out directly to the voters on their own and not waiting for the media to put spin on it, and try to speak with one voice to the extent they can, at least large blocks of the Congress, and kind of, you know, link arms and go at it together, I think that they'll see their approval ratings rise. And I will say, a lot of what the public doesn't get to see that goes on behind the scenes in Congress is very positive. You know, the chairman and ranking members who chair committees together, for example, when I was up on the Hill, Senator Grassley was the chairman of the Finance Committee. Max Baucus, the Democrat from Montana, was the ranking Democrat. But they met together every Tuesday for 2 hours from 4 o'clock to 6 o'clock to set the agenda for the committee for the week going forward, to talk, you know, what are your priorities, here are my priorities. And I'll point out, every bill that passed the Finance Committee during that period of time where the two of them were in leadership passed in a bipartisan manner, and almost all of them were unanimous. And I think that just goes to show what a little bit of relationship will do to helping the legislative process move and helping break the logjam in Congress. And most of what needs to happen up there is dialogue. Not enough of it does. Unfortunately, most of it happens through the lens of a camera. You don't even find out if a colleague's going to support or oppose your bill until they tell it to the nightly news, and then you see it there or you read it in the paper the next day. But that did happen much better under the previous president than it has under this one. And I think that if Trump will give the committee heads the chance to talk, and you know, if he says, hey, I want tax reform, but you guys up there, chairman, work out what that should look like and what you can get the most number of members on board for, and I'll sign it if I think that's a good course of action. I think if he does that and keeps a very open dialogue with them, we could have a very productive 2017 and probably a much more popular Congress.
That's very interesting. I want to thank you very much, Corey, for coming on with us. I'm sure we'd love to have you again soon. I'm
glad to be here.
Great.
Glad to come back.
So this is the Article One podcast with Tom and Tim and our guest, Corey Crowley. Thank you very much for your time and for listening to the podcast. And we hope to have you with us again soon. For links to differing opinions on this topic, please visit this podcast page at fedsoc.org/articlei. Thanks for listening to the Article One podcast with Tom and Tim. I invite you to subscribe on iTunes or Google Play, and please, if you enjoyed this podcast, tell a friend or colleague about it. If you want to learn more about the Article One initiative, please visit fedsoc.org/articlei. That's fedsoc.org/articlei. Again, thanks for listening and have a great day.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.